Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you're joining us today. Donald Trump says he will leave his businesses to prevent conflicts of interest as president. In a string of tweets this morning, the president-elect said, quote, "I will be leaving my great business in total in order to fully focus on running the country in order to make America great again." But Trump has so many business interests around the world. Separating Trump the business from Trump the president won't be easy. The Wall Street Journal's White House reporter Damian Poletta gave me an example of a potential conflict of interest.
Let's say his company wants to put a new building in, you know, London, and the British government decides to cut him some kind of sweetheart deal. Maybe they waive all the, you know, zoning rules, or they make the property tax-free, that sort of thing. I mean, that's obviously kind of a quid pro quo major conflict of interest. And so the question is, how does the U.S. government, how does the U.S. taxpayer ensure that there's not going to be this sort of arrangement? Even if Donald Trump, you know, plays it completely by the book and is completely ethical and doesn't seek any of these sorts of arrangements, maybe a foreign government thinks that they can curry favor with him by doing these sorts of things. Those are the sorts of pitfalls that the White House could run into. And the problem is that the Trump organization has so many investments around the world. Their last 10 investments have been overseas. It could be difficult to keep track of, you know, which investors are involved, which investors are making kind of side promises to, you know, foreign governments, that sort of thing. So there's obviously a lot of things here that are complicated and almost unprecedented in U.S. history.
Before we say more about conflicts of interest, Donald Trump tweeted that he's going to remove himself from his businesses entirely. What good does that tweet do?
Well, so the devil is in the details, so to speak. I mean, it's one thing for him to remove himself completely from the operations of the business, right? Let's say he doesn't have any say anymore in where they put a building or what kind of lease they arrange, you know, the terms of the deal, the interest rate, that sort of thing. But it's a whole different thing if he removes himself from ownership of the company. If he divests himself completely, he has no financial stake anymore. And that's the big question that so far the Trump transition team has not answered. You know, will he have any financial stake? Will he sort of bequeath it all or gift it all to his kids, which will trigger all sorts of tax, you know, issues? But if he still has a financial stake and he still has his name on these buildings all over the world, there still could be the appearance of a conflict of interest as far as foreign governments and that sort of thing are concerned.
Legally and politically, if he would hand the reins, the business reins, to his kids, would that let him off the conflict of interest hook?
You know, it's a great question, and I think we really don't know the answer yet. I mean, I think it depends on what sort of role his kids have in the White House, how the kids are presenting the business to foreign investors or even foreign governments. You know, are they suggesting that it's somehow connected to their father? Are they, you know, acting like it's a completely separate entity? Those are the sorts of questions I think that need to be answered. And, you know, quite frankly, it could take a long time before we know. I mean, one of the challenges with an organization like the Trump Organization, it could just take one rogue employee who decides to kind of go off the reservation and create a lot of headaches. You know, maybe they're trying to bribe a foreign official, that sort of thing, even though, you know, the president like Trump has nothing to do with it, no knowledge of it. It's that sort of thing that could create an issue when you have that sort of power centralized, you know, both in the White House and then in a global company that has his name.
You say it could create an issue. Hanging over this whole thing is the question of, could Trump stay enmeshed in his businesses and the presidency in such a way that he could get himself impeached?
I mean, obviously, that's something that's ground that we haven't covered before. I mean, we've never had a president quite like Donald Trump in terms of having a business empire like this. It's one thing to have a wealthy president come into office who has investments in like the stock market, mutual funds, and who can turn it all over to some sort of trustee who manages it and they have no knowledge. But, you know, obviously Donald Trump can't easily liquidate his real estate empire overnight. And so if the family retains all these properties, it's just going to create a lot of these challenges. And you know, I think it's way too early to be thinking about anything in terms of impeachment. But I think they're going to have to take these legal issues seriously from the get-go in order to kind of head off any sort of challenge from Democrats or others about whether there's been any sort of impropriety. Because quite frankly, I mean, it's one thing for Donald Trump to have, you know, his kids on board and have his kids understand, his adult children, you know, what they can and can't do. But if you have all these investments overseas, you know, it's going to be very hard to control what sorts of things people are saying in Indonesia or in Turkey, you know, or in Eastern Europe when, you know, they might not have day-to-day interaction with the Trump organization, but they could be making deals that somehow represent Donald Trump's interests.
Finally, Damian Pauletta, Wall Street Journal. Can I just ask you, what is it like to be the White House reporter heading into the Donald Trump administration?
That's a great question. So I can tell you, let's see, 2 weeks ago, I spent 12 consecutive hours in the lobby of Trump Tower watching people come and go. I spent last weekend right outside the Mar-a-Lago Resort in West Palm Beach. You know, it's a different kind of experience, I think, than covering President Obama. This is a president coming into power who we could have kind of a North Pole in New York, a South Pole in Florida, and then kind of a Mid-Atlantic bureau in the White House. I mean, we're all trying to figure out how this is going to work. It's a whole new experience for all of us. Obviously, there is a sense of kind of Hollywood or showmanship that's conveyed. You know, we all saw the pictures last night when the dinner with Mitt Romney, and I think Donald Trump kind of thrives on that. Whether he can keep that up once he gets into the White House and kind of into the bureaucracy of the federal government, I think that remains to be seen. But right now, he's kind of continuing with what he's doing, early morning tweets, late night tweets, being provocative, kind of controlling the narrative, and then having everyone else kind of play catch up.
And he's not even president yet. Can we call you again, Damian?
Anytime.
Damian Pauletta, Wall Street Journal's White House reporter. Thanks for this.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So as we said, Donald Trump tweeted this morning that he will leave his businesses to avoid any conflict of interest. Trump didn't say how that's going to happen, but he has gotten a response from the relevant federal agency. The official Twitter account of the Office of Government Ethics responded to Trump's Twitter account, @RealDonaldTrump, bravo, ! Only way to resolve these conflicts of interest is to divest. Good call, ! I saw the Washington Post White House reporter remark that seeing the normally staid bureaucratic Office of Government Ethics get involved in a Twitter fest and getting in on the ! The reporter said, something weird is going on. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke. Almost everywhere you look in the city, there are construction cranes. It's hard to remember a time when there was so much building going on in Seattle. Well, this prompted a question for KUOW's Local Wonder.
Ready? Okay. Hi, my name is Chris Spott. I'm a general contractor here in Seattle. And my question is, with all the construction I see and with the tunnel being excavated, where does all the dirt go?
If a general contractor doesn't know where the dirt goes, who does? Well, KUOW's Joshua McNichols does.
I started in Seattle's South Lake Union neighborhood, where Amazon has been building its headquarters. It'll have three towers and a building that looks like a giant glass golf ball. But all that architecture, it's just noise to Gary Horvitz. He doesn't get paid to think about that. He gets paid to think about dirt.
Whenever we're doing a project, if you're dealing with an architect, they're concerned with the glory of how high above ground the building will be. The first question I ask is, how deep in the ground is it going?
When you take out dirt, you make a hole. As a geotechnical engineer with Hart Krauser, Horvitz's job is to make sure holes like that don't collapse in on themselves. He's not working on this project, but he does this kind of work on other big buildings all the time. We met up at the Amazon site at a section they just started digging.
What kind of a hole are we going to see here?
For a building of this size, it'll probably be going down around 40 or 50 feet, and the amount of soil that will be generated might be on the order of 250,000 cubic yards.
How do you help someone understand how big that is, how voluminous that is?
Well, the way typically one would do it is a typical dump truck that you see going down the road holds 10 cubic yards. So if you're dealing with 250,000 cubic yards, that's 25,000 dump trucks full of soil.
This is not the first time this soil has been moved. It used to be part of Denny Hill. During Seattle's early years, the city flattened out the hill. Much of the dirt flowed into a river valley right here on Westlake Avenue.
Westlake used to be a stream valley, the headwaters of which were about where the Sheraton Hotel is now. And so this area along the spine of Westlake used to be about 30 or 40 feet lower than it is now.
But you can't just dump your extra dirt into a stream bed anymore. You need a place with a permit to take your dirt.
So where's all that dirt go?
Well, it goes a number of places. There are gravel pits or mines scattered throughout Puget Sound. And you, as you can imagine, these mines wind up being very large holes in the ground. And at some point when those mines are played out, they need to be filled back in as part of environmental reclamation.
One of those mines is in Monroe. I headed out to the Fiorito mine in the Cascade Foothills. The top of one of those hills was taken away. The rock was used in construction.
Mining companies often get a bad rap because people think, oh, you're cutting all down all the trees and you're wrecking the environment and basically ruining the earth. What people don't see is that you drive on the road and you have to have the rock products from somewhere. So if you don't mine, then you don't have roads to drive on.
That's Zach Fiorito, who's in charge of the mine now. He says after all the good rock was gone, they started filling up the hole left behind with dirt. Lots of dirt. That hole is now a hill, and that hill is growing.
That hill used to be about 60 feet below where we're standing. That's how much fill is there.
Wait, so is that all dirt, like from Seattle?
Dirt, concrete, asphalt from King County and Snohomish County.
Fiorito offers me a ride to the top of the hill in his truck. It's not an ordinary truck. It feels like something out of Star Wars. The wheels are tall as a grown man. Fiorito handles it like a race car over the quarry's bumpy roads.
Is there anything this vehicle cannot ride over?
It'll get stuck in the mud if the mud's, soft. Yeah.
As we're driving, dump truck drivers from all over the region radio in. They announce their arrival at the quarry.
American Pride, D-16, coming on the outbound scale.
Yeah, Nelson, he's going to follow you up, and don't forget to pick up your drop axle, please.
This mine takes dirt from about 300 trucks a day. At $100 to $150 bucks per truck, that's good money. But it wasn't always so good.
During the recession, it was super slow here, so we hardly got any material. Whereas now, we're getting a lot.
944 inbound, Traverse Island.
How long did it take to build this mountain up?
We started filling it probably in 1999. My best guess is there's probably 5 million tons of fill here, and there's approximately 3 million left that can go in.
We approach the top of the hill. It's a broad, flat, muddy plain about the size of a couple football fields. Around us, mountains and river valleys. It's beautiful up here. Three or four at a time, the dump trucks drop their burdens on the ground. A bulldozer comes and smooshes them out, forming another thin layer of this growing hill. All over the region, many picturesque places like this have been shaped and are still being shaped by our region's big projects. Seattle's waterfront tunnel, for example, is sending its dirt across Puget Sound by barge. It comes to rest in an old quarry on a stunning little finger of land near Port Ludlow on the Olympic Peninsula. Eventually, that land will become something completely different. It could become a housing development or a park. That sort of future offers Zach Fiorito something to feel good about.
I get to put it all back. I get to finish the slopes. I get to plant trees. I get to say, oh, okay, I'm making it nice again. You know, okay, yeah, yes, it's been a mess for however long the mine's been here, you know.
Decades, probably.
Decades, yeah. There's a certain amount of gratification from being able to make it, you know, you make it all nice again. It's like you're building a park.
So that's where the dirt goes from Seattle's big construction projects. It's part of a cycle. We dig holes in the county because we need materials so we can build things in the city. And then we use the dirt from the city to fill those holes back up again. In Monroe, I'm Joshua McNichols for KUOW's Local Wonder.
Yes, that whole story was inspired by a local wonder question from a listener named Chris Spott. And you can hear more stories from our local wonder series at KUOW.org, where you can see a drone video showing you where the dirt from the Bertha dig is going. God, we live in a beautiful place and a busy one. Check out the video at our website, KUOW.org, and leave us your local wonder about the Puget Sound region. If your question is chosen, then a KUOW reporter will investigate it. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. After the presidential election result was official,
I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton.
Reports of hate crimes and hate speech started to flow in to groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center. Several incidents have been reported here in the Seattle area. Vandalism, racist graffiti, hateful words, physical attacks. So what should you do if you're the target or if you're a witness to a hate crime? KUOW's David Hyde reports.
Seattle Police, Operator 32.
The 911 call came in 2 days after the presidential election.
Hi, Operator 32. I'm the security guard at Nathan Hale High School, and I wanted to report an incident that happened to one of my students this morning.
The security guard went on to tell the story of a 16-year-old student he described as of Middle Eastern descent. She was on her way to school when a man she did not know allegedly grabbed her by the arm and refused to let go.
And then he said something to the effect of, "My color people don't belong here. We're not attractive and we need to leave. We're toxic people and we're ruining this country."
According to the Seattle Police report, the student was too scared to yell for help and was in tears when she recounted the incident to police. That same week on the University of Washington Bothell campus, several men surrounded a group of Muslim female students. They demanded that the women remove their hijabs. And the following week, there was a possible hate crime on the UW-Seattle campus. A female Muslim student from Fargo, North Dakota, says she was struck in the head with a bottle and suffered a severe concussion. Jasmine Sami is civil rights manager at the Council on American-Islamic Relations. She spoke at a press conference about the attack and about how her community is feeling right now.
The morning after the elections, I started to receive text messages and phone calls from community members and emails also asking if they should send their children to school, if students at colleges and universities should be going to school, especially female Muslims who wear the veil, because they were very worried about what would happen.
What should you do if you're a witness or fear that you could be the target of a hate crime in this tense environment? Mina Sultana is co-president of the Muslim Students Association at the University of Washington. She says they now advise all Muslim students to walk with a buddy on and off campus.
And just be extra cautious of their surroundings.
And she adds,
I think it's really important for bystanders to step in, whether it's getting the victim out of the situation or reporting the incident.
But whether you're the target or the witness, all of the people I spoke with, it comes down to individual judgment. If the incident starts with hate speech, that's not a crime. But Sean Whitcomb with the Seattle Police Department advises,
if the language is directed at you, like singularly directed at you, and the person who's uttering it is focused on you, disengage. Disengage from that situation. Create some distance.
And above all,
take care of yourself. Do what you need to be safe.
And everyone I spoke with pretty much agreed, if you feel threatened for any reason, call 911 and make sure you get a copy of the police report and the officer's name. In Seattle, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
Were you a witness to hate speech or a hate crime in 2016? Were you the target? What happened and what did you do? Will you please call KUOW's listener feedback line and let us know about it? The number is 206-221-3663. 221-3663. So far, we've heard from a couple of KUOW listeners.
Hello, my name is James. I'm calling from Centralia, Washington. And I have to say that when asked, have I heard any hate speech in 2016? It's amazing. I've heard more in the last 1 year than I have in the last 49 years. And this is all in public, coffee shops, cafes, walking around, store shop owners who just start talking about this stuff. It's amazing. I grew up in Seattle and didn't think this existed anywhere outside the Deep South.
And here's another call we got about David Hyde's report on how to respond to a hate crime.
This is Andy Bartels from Tacoma, Washington. I was with my college-age students in Bellingham weekend before last, and there was a small march that went by, and one of the protesters had a little sign that said Black Lives Matter, and a person in the restaurant sitting a few tables away said, Black lives don't matter, and the whole restaurant got silent, and I don't think any of us knew what to do, and the waitress and the manager went right over to the man and said, we do not talk like that in this restaurant, and you don't have to pay for your meal, but you do have to leave. And he left, and the relief was palpable. But then afterwards, my daughter said, well, where did that person go from here? So that was our experience. And thank you for such a specific story with such specific suggestions. Really appreciate it. We can beat this because we love one another, ultimately. It's hard to do that sometimes. Take care. Bye.
Again, we'd like to share how you have responded to hate speech or a hate crime in 2016. So give us a call, 206-221-3663, 221-3663. Thanks to the folks who have called. Now, here's another response to bigotry and to the presidential election. Hari Kondabolu is a stand-up comedian, writer, podcaster. He got his start in comedy in Seattle about a decade ago, and he's gone on to perform on Conan and Jimmy Kimmel, Letterman, and to write for TV's Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. He's going to be at Seattle's Triple Door Theater next week before heading on a comedy tour through Red State America. He says he booked the shows before the election. I started out by just asking Hari how he's doing.
It's a weird time to be in this country right now because I think I'm one of those people that thought we were much further along than we actually were. I felt like media seems to depict a much more diverse America than I've ever seen, and certainly I've ever seen in media. And certainly I feel like, you know, we've made a lot of strides in terms of people's rights. You know, we're still very far away from where we should be. But like all of a sudden election night, it's like, wow, I really have been in this bubble. I've been in an East Coast and West Coast bubble for, you know, a great deal of my life. And unfortunately, those bubbles are not bulletproof, which is very frightening right now as a comedian that's traveling the country.
Yeah, we need thicker-walled bubbles.
No, that's the solution. That's my version of Trump's wall. It's just giant bubbles around the East and West Coast that can shelter us even further. I mean, it's a really scary time.
Have you been getting out of your Facebook bubble, your liberal bubble, your Thanksgiving bubble? What have you been doing about your bubble?
I mean, I guess it's an advantage in a really weird way. But one of the advantages of being a person of color or in an oppressed group is that we knew that we were in a bubble the whole time because, you know, we've had to function. And even when you're in that bubble, you deal with terrible things. You deal with hate, violence, and anger, and confusion. And, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about microaggressions, but there are also macroaggressions, which we fear, like death.
Death, the macroaggression.
The biggest macroaggression of them all, murder. And also, you know, it's funny, right after, I say it's funny just because I don't know how else to describe this stuff that's so awful. I read, you know, my Facebook timeline like everyone else, and I'm going down the list in the days after the election, and it's not just a mourning, you know, which one could expect if, you know, you're a progressive-minded person the day after Trump got elected. But it was story after story after story of people I know or people they know being victims of some kind of violence or harassment. Some of them in Seattle, right? And it's weird because when you lose something or when there's a tragedy, people's hateful reactions, they're not justified but somewhat understood, you know. Like after 9/11, the violence that was targeted towards brown people was disgusting and certainly questions the idea that we were all united. But at least you can understand historically how that kind of ignorance and seeking revenge works, right? Humans have done that in the past. This is weird because Trump won, so now it feels like a marking of territory. Like just like an animal, you're instead of peeing on a spot to say this is mine, you must destroy the other human. You must let them know that they either don't belong here or that you're better than them. And it's proven by the fact that our guy's in charge. It was more than an election, right? It was really a mandate against our values. It's very strange. It's a questioning critically of what I thought we were.
One course of action I've heard about is resistance. No normalizing this president. Constant resistance. Is that
Absolutely. Even
possible? What does that look like for you?
On a small level, like the making sure alt-right isn't normalized as a phrase. Like, why are we sugarcoating white supremacy and Nazism? Why are we doing that? Why should that be branded in a friendlier way? Like, there's no reason for that, you know? Like, that's one thing, to not be complacent and to be clear with language. I'm not talking about the alt-right. I'm talking about the white supremacists that are in charge. I'm talking about, you know, the fact Steve Bannon has connections to white supremacists and he's part of the Trump team. Like, things like that that cannot be sugarcoated. You know, we have to say things that might not make everyone happy all the time. We need to be allies to our friends who are struggling, whether they're women, whether they're people of color, whether they're people in the LGBTQ community, whether they're transgender. Because if there's this marking of territory after the election, wait till he's in office. You know what I mean? This is the prequel. We haven't even gotten to the film that's about to happen. And you know, that's scary. And as a comedian, it is not particularly funny. Like, there are going to be people listening to this right now, right in the middle of the interview, thinking, oh, I wonder what this man does. Certainly, he couldn't be a comedian, because a comedian says funny things from time to time and doesn't just drone on and on about the impending end of the world.
Well, where is comedy in here for you?
It's where it's always been. You know, it's in questioning the status quo. It's in punching upwards. And if anything, the way I suppose it helps me in the slightest way is not that I can make fun of Trump now. It's because the things I've always talked about have been stories of oppression, right? And you have a president and a group of people that aren't dog whistling. There are no hidden messages. They scream. So everyone's on the same page. You know, he was talking about taking away citizenship of people if they burn the American flag. Like, that's astonishing. The president's saying it. We're all on the same page now. So I suppose the things I've been doing historically, maybe they make more sense. Because there's no dog whistling. I don't need to decode. It's right out there now.
Already, though, I hear some people saying, oh, just don't even flag burning. No one's going to jail for flag burning. He just wants that Twitter love, which equals Twitter hate, which equals Twitter love. When do you take every Trump bit seriously, or when do you focus your energy?
He's going to be the president of the United States of America. The things he says have value, right? And I think the media in particular should be afraid. W. Kamau Bell and I were interviewing Jake Tapper on our podcast, Politically Reactive, and I'd asked him, you know, because Trump has all these traditional strongman tendencies, you know, when he talks about a list of enemies, you know, when people talk about his list of enemies, and when he talks about jailing his opponent during the presidential election, and when he's critical of the press and he has a thin skin, those are traditional things that dictators have. Are you worried as a member of the media? And I asked him that, I guess, somewhat tongue in cheek, but also somewhat curious as to what he'd say. And he said, of course I'm worried. Of course that's something I think about. You know, how could you not? And I didn't really want to hear that from Jake Tapper. I was hoping he'd tell me that I was a nut. But the fact that he's worried about it too, somebody in the mainstream media, not just a dissenting voice, from the internet or from Democracy Now!, right? Not Amy Goodman. We're talking about somebody who's a big voice on CNN expressing concern. That should make all of us afraid that these aren't just words.
I'm talking with Hari Kondabolu, comedian. He's a stand-up comedian. What do you think's the biggest thing that's been accomplished? I mean, some people have been celebrating since the election, but some people have been, there's protesting, there's writing legislators, there's donating to social justice organizations. What's been accomplished so far?
You know, on the left, people always talk about the complacency of the left, partly because there are so many issues and there are so many focuses, which I don't think is bad. I think that's part of what makes people on the left special. However, if you're talking about complacency, which certainly we had in this election since the voter turnout was so terrible, this is bringing people together. You know, this fear of what Trump could mean to so many different people is bringing people together. It's not an abstract threat. It feels like a real threat. So that's a unifying thing. There's something positive in the lack of complacency because we need to go out there now.
Rallying cry, sustain the fear. Did I get you right?
I don't think we should sustain the fear, but we should certainly be awake. You know, I don't think it's time to be asleep because we were asleep. A lot of us were asleep and look at what happened, right? It also means that you have to speak up. I said this recently, you know, over Thanksgiving for those white folks who are with their families that maybe sometimes embarrass them, that say things that feel like they're from another era and who probably say that in public as well. And you just try to avoid having the conversation to get through the one meal. No, it's time to ruin Thanksgiving. It's time to ruin Christmas. The next 4 years of Thanksgiving should be terrible. I think you got to put stuff out there.
So did you succeed in humanizing people by ruining Thanksgiving?
my Thanksgiving historically has been with my parents, who often – my mother has made tandoori chicken. Mm-hmm. She's made a quail. So she has her own spin. I think we had pheasant 1 year. It's really weird, actually. I don't know why she doesn't just stick with turkey. But sometimes when I do have Thanksgiving with friends who aren't my parents, if they're white, it's with Seattle liberals. So you know I'm not ruining anyone's Thanksgiving, to be perfectly honest.
You didn't fight with a Hindu uncle who doesn't like the Muslims?
No, okay. Not generally. Those arguments have happened, but not over Thanksgiving.
Okay.
But I do think that you know it's not always the responsibility of whether it's people of color or women or any oppressed group to always have to fight. So, you know, for those of you who are uncomfortable about hearing about privilege all the time, okay, we'll stop talking about it if you use it. Because now would be the time. It's time to use your superpowers, right? Because we're in trouble right now. And I know, like, it might sound like, oh, he's lost it. He's nutty. He's overreacting to an election. I don't know, man. I thought maybe I was until I read all the stories of violence, when I see the hostility and anger that maybe perhaps was always there, but all of a sudden it's real in a way that I don't know. I can feel it. And I haven't started touring all the country. I'm still on the West Coast, but I'm going to be touring the country this year and next year. I'm going to be all over the place. And I want to be able to say I went to the city and I got to use my First Amendment rights and I got to practice my art form and I wasn't afraid. I want to be able to say that.
Is your mom scared for you on your comedy tour of red states?
My mom's a mom. Moms are afraid of everything. She's afraid when I leave the house and I don't even live at home and she's worried about me walking around in New York. And I am from New York. And I told her, are you worried about this? And she says, yes, but I'm trying not to think about it and I'm trying not to tell you because she knows I'm thinking about it. For the first time, we're on the same page about being afraid for me. But I thought a lot about the fact that, you know, this is my one thing. I can speak publicly and I do it well and I make people laugh. And maybe not in this interview, but generally, I am able to make people laugh. And it's my way of expressing my truth. And I'm not going to give up my one thing. That's the one thing I have. It's the thing that has always made me feel alive. And I'm not going to give that up. I mean, Lenny Bruce died for the First Amendment. He's the only one who truly suffered for the First Amendment among comedians. And it would be a disservice to that legacy for me to be so afraid that I stop speaking. Like, I believe in the First Amendment. And for all those people who claim political correctness is destroying the First Amendment, the threat of imprisonment for expressing your First Amendment rights, that That is what you should be railing against, not people's use of free speech to question free speech. That apparently is what political correctness is. That is not the problem. The problem is the threat of not being able to use your free speech rights without penalty from the government. I find that frightening. And, you know, my parents are scared, as they should be, because they're parents and they are brown and I'm brown in this country right now. And I'm scared. But this is when you have to stand up. I can't tell other people to stand up if I'm backing out of the fight, you know. And at the end of the day, I know that when I make people laugh, it's cathartic for me and for them. It helps the people in that room, and it is a beautiful experience. I'm not going to give that up for anybody.
Comedian and writer Hari Kondabolu, co-host of the Politically Reactive podcast with W. Kamau Bell. Hari's going to be at Seattle's Triple Door next week. Late show tickets are still available. He will be performing comedy. He assures you of that. You heard Hari note that he was not funny in our interview, so this is a little proof that he does, in fact, tell jokes on stage in front of audiences.
Regardless of who wins the next election, right, I just don't want to hear my liberal friends tell me that they're moving to Canada, right? Because I've heard this for years. If Bush wins, I'm moving to Canada. If we go to war in Iraq, I'm moving to Canada. Man, if Bush wins again, I'm moving to Canada. You're not moving to Canada. Nobody's moving to Canada. Because I don't know if you all know this, Canada does not have a special visa for American liberal cowards, right? That's not how the immigration system works.
This is KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Coming up, you're going to hear about Cuba after Castro. And Vaughn Palmer will tell you about Canada's controversial oil pipeline. Yep, Canada. Coming back. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Fidel Castro's death on Friday ended an era that began with his Cuban Revolution in 1959. His death has led to celebrating in the streets and to tearful eulogies. Andrew Gomez understands that contradiction. His father emigrated from Cuba, and now Andrew teaches modern Latin American history at the University of Puget Sound. He was visiting family in Miami when the news hit, and the reaction he saw was not what you might have seen on CNN.
So my father, unlike his parents, was wildly supportive of the Cuban Revolution, as many young people were. They were eager to see a change. They were eager to see a truly independent Cuba that was not dependent on U.S. interests. But over time, over the decades, he grew disillusioned with the revolution and saw the widespread corruption, the censorship of the press, the imprisonment of political opponents. And so gradually, he became disenchanted with it. And when he had an opportunity in 1980 during the Mariel boatlift, that's when he fled the island and moved to Miami.
Yes, this is the special window of time when Castro said to Cubans, okay, you want to leave Cuba? Leave Cuba.
Yes, and then 125,000 Cubans said yes.
125,000.
My grandmother, who had been in Miami for years, she had moved in the early 70s, arranged for him to be on a boat, and that's how he came over.
What you've said, he was disillusioned, and you said a little bit about why, but I still want to understand why, personally, how your father went from sort of a revolutionary to climbing in that boat. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So, I mean, it's important to understand why Fidel Castro was popular in the 50s. So Fulgencio Batista, who was the dictator that ruled in Cuba from 1952 to 1959, he had an administration that was wildly corrupt. There was vast inequality in Cuba during this period. And U.S. interests played a huge role on the island. And so many young Cubans wanted a change. So my father was one of those Cubans. And so that was the original support. And, you know, it's important to remember that in the beginning of the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro did not outline that he was a Marxist. That happened after he took power. And so my father and people like him supported the movement. And then over time, as that rhetoric became action, he started to see, you know, the other forms of inequality and unfairness that took over in Cuba. And so that became an overwhelming feeling that over time he grew restless about and decided that he had to leave the island.
Yeah, it was a repressive government. It was he so much for free elections.
Yeah, exactly. Reneging on all those promises of free elections, the fact that there was only one party rule, the fact that political opponents were imprisoned and sometimes killed, the fact that gay and lesbians were sent to labor camps. It was a wildly repressive government, particularly in the early years of the Cuban Revolution.
But as you well know, Castro also brought health care and free education and more. So I wonder, when, by the time you were growing up in Miami, where your father had come to, who was Fidel Castro to you growing up?
Well, if you're a Cuban-American kid growing up in Miami, he is the devil incarnate, right? You get this very caricatured vision of him. I mean, over time, I would have more serious discussions with my father, and then, you know, I ended up being trained as an academic historian. So you grow to have a more nuanced view. And so, yes, absolutely, I concede the achievements regarding healthcare and education and literacy and his importance as a figure in the fight against anti-colonialism. But you still have to take him as a whole person. And so his rule as a despot is still largely how I and most Cuban Americans will remember him.
Not only did you have a complicated view of him, but your family situation was complicated because your older sister decided to stay behind when your father left. What was her life like in Cuba?
Yeah, so that was the fascinating thing. So my sister was supposed to leave with my father the day he was set to leave in 1980. And she was 18 and she was in love with a boy and she decided to stay. And so her life has been incredibly difficult. So she still lives in Camagüey, the city that my father was born and raised in. And so she has been through all of it. And I remember speaking with her in the 90s during the special period. This is when the Soviet Union collapsed and Cuba went through this prolonged economic depression. And it was terrible. And had it not been for money that, you know, my family's been funneling to her, her life would be much more difficult.
We're talking with a professor of modern Latin American history and American history at University of Puget Sound, Andrew Gomez. Why did you decide to study Latin American history, specifically Cuban American?
I was interested in my own history, and I was interested in the broader history of Cubans in the United States. We hold a pretty unique place in the history of this country. There's only 2 million of us, but we wield a considerable political power. And so I was always interested in learning more about that history and the longer history of Cuban Americans in the United States.
How did that change your view? How did your study change your view of Castro?
Well, you grow to have a more nuanced view, not just of Castro, but of American policy towards Cuba. And so even though I still hold a negative view of the Castro regime, I also hold a negative view of U.S. policy in Cuba. And I'm part of a younger generation of Cuban Americans that is staunchly opposed to the Cuban embargo because it has been an abject failure. And so you grow to hold both of those things in your head at the same time, that I can critique what's going on in Cuba, particularly in regards to human rights, but that I can also critique the failures of U.S. policy in Cuba.
What do you want from President Trump when it comes to Cuba?
That's the big question, isn't it? I would hope that he would take pause and realize that rolling back the changes that Obama has put into place would cause potentially irreparable harm between the relationship between Cuba and the United States. Because we're in this very unique moment where a younger generation of Cuban Americans here in the United States and a younger generation of Cubans in Cuba are much more receptive to change. And there's a lot of opportunity there. And to retreat to a hardline stance would actually only embolden hardline communists in Cuba. And it would allow them to say, you see, this is what the United States is. The Obama administration was a temporary reprieve, and the real legacy of the United States is seen in this type of bluster and commandeering presence.
Everything you had in your head on the day Fidel Castro died, your history, your study, you were in Miami, the city that so many people came to when they left Cuba. What was it like to be in Miami that day?
That was the surreal part, driving around the city, talking to other Cuban Americans that I grew up with, because you're taking stock of the fact that this city has been, its modern trajectory at least, entirely shaped by this person and his revolution. And of course, I've always known that intellectually, but it's another thing to have that all sink in. I mean, to know that the vast majority of the 2 million Cuban Americans in the United States have been directly or indirectly affected by this man and his movement, that's a lot to take in and reckon with.
Castro so famously said when he was young, "History will absolve me." After Castro's death, President Obama said history will judge him. How do you think history will see Fidel Castro?
Mixed. And again, it depends on your perspective, right? So if you're a part of the Latin American left, you see him as someone who stood up to U.S. imperialism and the long history of U.S. intervention in Latin America. And you can cherry pick that view and see him as that. But again, I think most of us, and I think the way he'll generally be remembered is for a mixed record that looks more at his repressive policies, and particularly those early years in the revolution, as showing the deep flaws of the Cuban Revolution and the deep flaws of his personality.
The Cuban-American community is so important to Miami. What is it like for you now to be on the complete opposite corner of America in the Puget Sound region?
I'm a Cuban-American in Seattle, so it's isolating, to say the least. And so, that's very different. I'm not as plugged in anymore to those everyday discussions and so on. And you do feel isolated in that respect, being a Latino generally in the Puget Sound region. But that's why those connections are so important to my family and talking to my friends, because that's what keeps me connected to that history and that culture.
Andrew Gomez teaches modern Latin American history and U.S. history at the University of Puget Sound. His father came from Fidel Castro's Cuba to Florida during the Mariel boat lift of 1980. Andrew was in Miami on Friday when Castro died. Cuba and the United States have reopened their relations, of course, but some dissidents in Cuba say that repression, detentions, and harassment are still happening. We're going to bring you a report on this coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you're with us today. Also in the news today, oil tanker traffic could increase dramatically in the Salish Sea. Yesterday, the government of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau approved a major expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline from the tar sands of Alberta to near Vancouver, B.C. Let us welcome Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer now. Vaughn, we think of Justin Trudeau as an environmentalist here, but he's going against the wishes of environmental groups and Vancouver area mayors and First Nations and Salish tribes. Why?
Well, he's making a pretty big decision here, Bill, you're right, and a very controversial one. The Prime Minister announced this in Ottawa yesterday, and he said, look, we've brought in a plan to phase out coal-fired generation in Canada. We have brought in carbon pricing. We have brought in targets under Paris. We have done a whole bunch of things on the environmental side. The Canadian economy needs to get its oil to world markets. And that is what we are doing today. He was flanked when he announced it by the Premier of Alberta, Rachel Notley, who's of the party of the left, the New Democrats. And yes, he has plunged into a major controversy. I think the best comment on this was the one made yesterday by an observer, which was, it is one thing to approve a pipeline. It is another thing to get a pipeline actually built. Trudeau's predecessor, Stephen Harper, approved a pipeline through British Columbia as well, and even as he was approving this pipeline yesterday, Trudeau killed another pipeline. So it's we're still a long way from construction here. It's approval with 157 conditions, Bill, and I think without the kind of social license that a lot of people expect for a big project like this as well.
So the idea is that it's more dangerous and more expensive to move oil by rail instead of pipeline?
That's one of the things they said. There's an interesting comment, too. I just listened to a bunch of press conferences this morning, including from the guy whose company wants to build this, Kinder Morgan. And he pointed out that the oil that comes, there's already a pipeline.
Yes.
They own it, right? So what they're going to do is build a second pipeline alongside the first. So they think that's one reason why they think they can get it built. But he pointed out that the oil right now that comes through that pipeline goes to three places. Some of it goes into tankers that's shipped out of British Columbia on existing tanker traffic. Some of it is used in British Columbia in the refinery, a Chevron-owned refinery in B.C. But there's a spur line that goes to Washington State. So some of that oil already goes to Washington State. So he was asked, well, you know, if you're going to double your capacity, where's the oil going to go? And he said, well, the market will determine that. He said some of the new oil may well go to Washington State. Some of it will certainly be put into tankers and shipped out of British Columbia, and some of it will be used in British Columbia. So there's sort of three sets of implications for this. It's not just more tankers out of the Port of Vancouver.
Right. Speaking of the tankers, though, for now, hundreds of more oil tankers coming past San Juan Island through the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And isn't tar sands oil dirtier than what would come out of, say, a Texas well?
Yes, there is an issue with that, which is if there's a spill. The Trudeau government, however, recently announced a massive increase in the resources to deal with both to prevent spills and to deal with them if they happen. So we will have ocean-going tugs for the first time. We will have tug escorts for tankers. And as a British Columbian, I would point out that most of the tankers that go by through the Strait of Juan de Fuca right now are bringing oil from Alaska to the refineries in Washington State.
Right.
So we've put up with your tankers for a long time. I guess the Canadian government message back is going to be, now you have to put up with ours.
Right. Those shipping lanes go both ways. So finally, yeah. Vaughn, well, I don't know if this is final, but we mentioned the mayors of Vancouver and Victoria, Burnaby, that's the terminal site.
Yes.
They want jobs. They seem to be against this pipeline expansion. You have First Nations opposing. So what's the potential for having this thing built or stopped?
You know, it's still a long way from that. I think that's the most honest thing you can say. I got 24 press releases last evening, Bill, from different environmental groups and First Nation groups in British Columbia opposing this on one ground or another. We're headed for a provincial election in British Columbia next year, Bill. Two of our three parties, the Greens and the New Democrats, both are opposed to this. Premier Christy Clark this morning, she's close to approving it. She says the British Columbia government still has about 10 different things they need to get sorted out. But it sounds as if we're headed for a provincial election next year where two parties will be opposed, one will be in favor. And, of course, Trudeau himself faces some difficulties with his members of parliament from British Columbia. We've had four of Trudeau's 17 MPs representing BC come out and say they are disappointed with this decision. They have serious reservations about it. So as I say, we are still a long way from a start of construction. The company would like to start building the pipeline in September of next year, but I would be surprised if they get to that point. I think they'll be dealing with protests, court injunctions, and perhaps some legal battles that could hold things up for longer than a few months.
We have 1 minute left, Vaughn. So finally, you briefly mentioned one pipeline yes, one pipeline no. This is the pipeline through the Great Bear Rainforest that we've talked about. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's no, and the government is also putting a moratorium on tankers in British Columbia waters up there. So, you know, as I say, Bill, that pipeline was approved by the previous government in 2014 with 200 conditions. It is now dead. Of course, at the same time, as you will know, the president-elect of the United States is talking about reactivating the Keystone Pipeline, which would take oil from Canada to Texas. So, you know, as I say, we've been talking about pipelines for a long time, Bill. No one's built anything for several years, and it's not clear to me exactly what is going to get built, if anything, in the next year or two.
Should be interesting to watch. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, thanks as always.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Thanks for tuning in to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, live tweeting at KUOW.